Hello everyone, this is Bob Zeta, my amateur radio call sign, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. Here on the Courage and Hemp System, I'll be reading for you in digest format, CQ Magazine, for August 2011. CQ is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor, Richard S. Mawson, amateur radio call, W2VU. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. The website is www.handyham.org. For our purposes, Handy Ham is always spelled lowercase handiham, one word, at Courage, courage, .org. Let's begin today with Ham Radio News. Portuguese edition of CQ to debut in Brazil. A new Portuguese language edition of CQ is due to be launched this month in Brazil. The new edition will be published by Radio Haas, a major Brazilian amateur radio dealer. It will be published bi-monthly and will contain a mix of articles translated from the United States edition and original material printed specifically for the Brazilian ham audience. This is the same arrangement that CQ has with the publishers of its Spanish edition, CQ Radio Amateur. FCC Chief visits Hamvention. Feral Communications Chairman Julius Granikowski made a surprise visit to the Dayton Hamvention during an unplanned layover in Dayton, Ohio. According to Hamvention officials, Granikowski was flying back to Washington on Friday, May the 20th, when his plane was diverted to Dayton because of severe weather in the Midwest. He was told he might have trouble finding a hotel room because of all the ham radio operators in town. After finding a room, he decided to visit the show on Saturday morning before returning to Washington. He spent about 2 hours at Hara Arena talking with hams and checking out the equipment displays. Astronaut Wheelock praises ham radio at Dayton. A planned guest at this year's Dayton Hamvention was astronaut Doug Wheelock, amateur call KF5BOC, a call sign he never used. Quoting here, "I call that my gravity call sign," close quote, Wheeler told Newsline. He continued, "My real call sign is NA1SS from the space station." He said that ham radio provided a great way to relax and decompress as he and his crewmates worked to fix a pump failure that required 3 spacewalks to repair. Plus, he said, having you guys, that is to say the amateur radio community throughout the world, as an emergency contact for us around the globe was a warm, warm feeling for me as a commander. There are new access rules for QRZ.com. Users of QRZ.com call sign database must now be registered and sign in before getting access to any name or address data. Owner Fred Lloyd, Alpha Alpha 7 Bravo Quebec, explained in a posting that routine access to the database was being slowed down by a growing number of automated systems trying to harvest massive amounts of data at one time. Registration is free. Ham users may access a minimum of 150 call signs per day, not including their own. Non-ham users are limited to 25 lookups per day. And QRZ subscribers will continue to have unlimited access. Progress, but no changes yet in HR 607. A group of New York hams met in May with the sponsor of HR 607, the bill that would create a nationwide interoperable radio service for public safety officials. But at the cost of radio frequencies, 420 through 440 megahertz, and 450 through 470 megahertz. According to participants, Representative Peter King, Republican of New York, promised to have the bill amended to remove the section that deals with auctioning off spectrum below 512 megahertz. And staff members later confirmed that the congressman had made that request of Representative Greg Walden, Republican of Oregon, who is chairman of the Subcommittee on Technology, Communications, and the Internet. His call is W7EQI. The committee is now in charge of the bill. Reportedly, Walden agreed to have the section removed, but as this is written in late June, no action had been yet taken to amending the bill. Meanwhile, in the Senate, Senators Joe Lieberman, independent of Connecticut, and John McCain, Republican of Arizona, introduced a companion bill to H.R. 607. The Senate bill is S-1040. It does not call for auctioning off any spectrum below 1675 megahertz. However, it would require the FCC to not renew current public safety licenses below 512 megahertz unless the licensee can show that A, that migration to a different frequency band will cause considerable economic hardship to the state or local government jurisdiction in which such licensee is located, B, migration to a different spectrum band that would adversely impact the ability of the licensee to protect and serve the community in which such licensee is located, or C, there are an insufficient number of frequencies above the 700 megahertz band to support the land mobile communications needs of the licensee. I suppose, folks, it seems to me, based on what's been going on in Congress this last 3 or 4 months, it's about as slow as it's ever been. Let's hope it never gets any slower. So I would suggest we don't hold our breath too long on these changes. They are good changes, protective changes for the amateur community. But the way the Congress is operating lately, they have a lot of things on their mind, don't they now, huh? Our next news report. New HF radar proposal could impact ham bands. Geez, it sounds like they're all after us, doesn't it, huh? The National Telecommunications and Information Administration, acronym NTIA, which regulates federal government spectrum usage and advises the President on telecommunications matters, has proposed establishing oceanographic radar allocations at several HF frequency segments, including the 60-meter amateur band and immediately adjacent to the 20-meter ham band. According to the American Radio Relay League, the recommendation to propose these allocations at next year's World Radio Communication Conference, WARC 12, came as a surprise to those members of a U.S. WRC working group set up by the FCC, including an ARRL representative, that had proposed different sets of frequencies and concluded that sharing between these radars and amateurs would be difficult at best. Apparently, there has not yet been an explanation of why NTIA made these specific proposals or why it disregarded the working group's advice. More to come on this one also. And one last news note of worth. Japan drops all amateur code tests. Back in the 1950s, Japan became the first country to issue an amateur license that did not require a Morse code exam, the so-called Class 4 license in Japan. However, it has continued to require code tests for the Class 1 and Class 2 licenses, even as most of the rest of the world has ended amateur code test requirements. Now, according to Newsline, effective October 1, Japan will no longer require code tests for any class of amateur license. Interestingly, on an issue about which so many hams have been so passionate for so many decades, a request for comments on the proposed rule change drew only 39 responses. Now, if any of you listeners has internet capabilities and you'd like to get additional and updated news, it is available on the Ham Radio News page of the CQ website at http://www.cq-amateur-radio.com. Let's take a look now at Zero Bias, the CQ editorial by the editor Richard Mawson, W2VU. We keep hearing this word, the Chinese Connection. I'm in the middle of reading a fascinating book about Chinese voyages of discovery in the early 15th century. And folks, I'll pause here just to give you the reference. The author is Menzies, Gavin. The last name M-E-N-Z-I-E-S. First name Gavin, G-A-V-I-N. Numerals 1421, colon. It's titled, The Year China Discovered America, published by HarperCollins, New York. The year 2004. The author claims to have evidence that, among other things, the Chinese landed and established colonies in the Americas about 80 years before Columbus discovered the New World. I haven't gotten far enough in yet to comment on that. But the first part of the book lays the groundwork for discovering medieval Chinese history and culture and explaining how China spread its influence and came to dominate foreign trade in Asia and Africa at the time. Despite having the world's largest army and navy, and having already invented gunpowder and developed firearms, this book's author says it wasn't China's style to simply invade a place and take it over. Rather, the Chinese sent treasure ships full of the finest goods, not only to trade, but to bestow as gifts on local rulers. Once trading relationships were established, these rulers were given every imaginable luxury and invited to major events in China, with the Chinese providing transportation and picking up the tab for everything. I'm getting more interested as I read this to you folks. Better check that book out. Of course, all this came at a price. If the foreign leaders wanted to continue to benefit from China's largesse, and if they wanted their highly profitable trade with China to continue and grow, then they had to pay tribute to China, both financially and by swearing allegiance to the Chinese emperor. The Chinese came to dominate the region generally without firing a shot, even though they were the only ones at the time with guns. It would do us well here in the West to study more Chinese history. I bring this up because, as many of you are aware, the past year has been the introduction to the U.S. market of ham gear from China. The two major brands we have seen so far are the WOUXON, that's the brand name. It's pronounced Ochin. Gee, I'm glad they did that for me, ladies and gentlemen, because I've had to try that word out a couple of months in a row now, and I don't think I did a very good job. I don't think I made it sound like Ochin. It's spelled W-O-U-X-O-N, and the letters T-Y-T, Tango, Yankee Tango. That's the Quanzhou TYT Electric Company. The prices are very low, and from all reports we've heard, the radios work well, too. At Ham Common, Texas this past June, one dealer selling these new rigs wanted to be sure everyone in the hall knew how well they were doing, so the booth staff banged a big bong every time a ham bought one. Following a commercial tradition that is at least 700 years old, the Chinese are establishing themselves in the ham radio market with quality goods at low prices that significantly undercut their competition. Of course, their competition is acutely aware of this, especially the Japanese manufacturers, who know from their own experience how effective this strategy can be. After all, it's been just over 40 years since the first ad for a Japanese radio appeared in U.S. ham magazines. The Japanese manufacturers used a similar approach, offering quality goods at low prices that significantly undercut their competition, starting with low-cost VHF FM gear, and then moving into higher-priced HF equipment as well. Most of the long-established U.S. manufacturers And I put that in quotes because many of them had only been in business about 40 years themselves at that point, could not or would not respond effectively, and eventually dropped out of the amateur market, giving the Japanese manufacturers some dominance for the past three decades. Now, the Chinese manufacturers appear to be adopting similar tactics, and the question becomes whether the Japanese manufacturers will learn from their own success and how, or if, they will adapt to meet this new challenge. Ultimately, it will be up to you, the consumer, to decide which radios from which manufacturers give you the greatest value for your dollar. Other issues that may merit consideration by consumers include possible Chinese government subsidies to hold down prices on exported goods, and questions about working conditions and worker pay at Chinese factories. We know nothing about these specific companies, only that this is an issue in the broader topic of U.S.-China trade. And, of course, we, the consumer, should not forget that the United States amateur radio manufacturing industry has rebounded, with newer companies taking leadership positions in several areas of the ham marketplace. One thing is certain, radios from China will be a part of the ham radio landscape for many years to come, and the presence of these new players in the market will continue to be seen in magazines, on dealer shelves, and at ham fests around America. Editor Rich Mawson continues in Zero Bias News with commentary on the Dayton and Dallas Hamfests. Speaking of Hamfests, both Dayton and Dallas, that's HamCom, seem to be down a little in attendance this year, but most dealers reported strong sales nonetheless. Getting to and from Dayton proved to be challenging this year as well. It took me 13 hours to get there from New Jersey, which wouldn't have been too terrible if I was driving, but I was flying. And after the show, both that manager Chip Margellis, K7JA, and popular communications and World Radio Online editor Richard Fisher, KI6SN, got stranded overnight at different airports while trying to get home to California. Ignoring all this, actually being at Dayton was its usual incredible experience. Yes, there was the sewer backup that shut down nearly all of the restrooms on Saturday afternoon and sent sewage seeping across the parts of the flea market. But on the other hand, there was the unplanned and unannounced visit on Saturday morning of FCC Chairman Julius Drenikowski, and the usual controlled chaos at the CQ booth. Working a booth at Dayton is a lot like running a pileup on a de-expedition. There's a constant line of people waiting to work you. You can only work one at a time, and you have to hope all the others behave until you get to them. 99% of the time, they do. But the people you get to meet are the best part. Attendees at Dayton truly cover the full spectrum of the ham radio hobby. All, of course, are just plain hams having fun and chatting on a first-name basis, even though among those just plain hams were at least one Nobel laureate, two retired admirals, a former ambassador, and at least one astronaut. It sure is a good thing we don't have to QSL all those eyeball QSOs at the booth. Hi, hi. Now, here are a couple of issue notes. Our coverage of ham radio's response to the wicked spring weather across the United States continues this month with a detailed look at how SATURN, that's an acronym for Salvation Army Team Emergency Radio Network, how SATURN volunteers helped out in Joplin, Missouri, after a massive tornado struck that city. And youth editor Brittany Decker, up here in good old New Hampshire, New England, KB1OGL shares her experience with, and lessons learned from, a too-close-for-comfort encounter with lightning at her home in New Hampshire. It's titled, A Striking Story. We'll read that for you when we come to it. Plus, of course, we have the single sideband results of last year's CQ Worldwide DX contest. Once again, this truly worldwide contest made its own propagation. Nearly 24 new records were set, and we received over 6,500 logs, showing operation from 232 countries, including China. 73, W2VU, Rich Mawson. Well, folks, I'm going to jump right into what few announcements might be pertinent to this date and time in August. A side comment on my part. For whatever reason, the Seacoop Publishing Company never releases their magazines, either in the stores, it would seem to me, or get received by mail. Before the very beginning of any given month, for instance, I'm recording this for you on August the 8th, I got my CQ magazine that I'm reading to you now. I think it was on August the 6th. That's pretty late, actually, for what magazines are usually capable of doing if they choose to. Only speaking from my own experience, every magazine that I got for, let's say, August, I got about the 10th, 12th, 15th of July. But be that as it will be, the first announcement listed is for the International Lighthouse Lightship Weekend activities. That has been going on all of this first week in August, and today is August the 7th. It's ending tomorrow. Before you receive this information on your connection with the Courage Handyham system on the internet. And I gotta tell you, nobody's any faster at putting up their audio and program responsibilities than this wonderful Courage Handyham system and Patrick Tice, the editor. Coming up on August the 28th is the 2011 Hawaii QSO Party. Starts at 0400 Universal Time Constant UTC on the 27th to 0200 UTC on the 28th. It's going to be all over the amateur bands if you're interested and have followed in the past. I'm sure you can find it somewhere on your favorite mode. And I have to chuckle here also. I'm having a little fun with this today, folks, because here comes one telling us about the Punta Gorda Lighthouse the Expedition. That's Southern Humboldt County, California. That's another great organization. They're also participating in the Lighthouse Session, but they're too late for us. Sorry about that. Now we have the following special event stations that are scheduled for August. Well, the first one here, too, was K3D, Kilo 3 Delta, honoring the world's first baseball game play-by-play broadcast at Forbes Field, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That one was, 2 days ago. Oh, forgive me. I'm feeling pretty good today. I'm trying to have a good time with this also. But moving onward and upward, amateur special event called N7C, November 7, Charlie. Commemorating the Navajo Code Talkers of World War II. Remember them, you old guys? That's from Willow Rock, Arizona, August the 12th through 14th. They're going to be on two specific frequencies, 14.265 and 7.265 megahertz. QSL information, if you're interested in that, is 2N7HG and N7C. If you need to do that, look at QRZ.com. I just gave you an announcement that they want you to register now before you can look them up. So there's a little more work there involved. Another special event station, W7SVD, Whiskey 7 Sierra Victor Delta, commemorating the establishment of the National Park Service in 1916. Montezuma Pass, high in the Hokochoka Mountains of southeastern Arizona at Coronado National Memorial. That's August 27th. All kinds of frequencies. You'll find them if you listen up closely as well. And we'll conclude these announcements with the following Hamfest, etc., that are slated for August. August 12th to 14th, 2011 Pacific Northwest DX Convention. It's being held at the Everett Holiday Inn, Everett, Washington, sponsored by the Western Washington DX Club. August 13th, Tri-State Amateur Radio Association Hamfest and Computer Show. It's at Veterans Memorial Fieldhouse, Huntington, West Virginia. August the 20th, 2011 East Central Hamfest, Vermilion County Fairgrounds, Danville, Illinois. Sponsor, Vermilion County Amateur Radio Association. August the 27th, Owen-Monroe, Amateur Radio Hamfest, Owen County Fairgrounds, Spencer, Indiana, sponsored by the Owen County Amateur Radio Association and the Bloomington Amateur Radio Club. And folks, I'm going to make this additional comment that is printed at the bottom of these announcements. Please submit Hamfest and special event announcements at least 3 months in advance by email to hamfest, one word, at cq-amateur-radio.com or special event, one word, at cq-amateur-radio.com or by postal mail to the magazine address, CQ Magazine, Attention, Hamfests or Special Events, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. I guess you might agree with me that based upon the way I was chattering about it at the very beginning, it's probably a good idea if you really know you're going to have something to go at least 3 months in advance, and their announcements might have been in the July issue, and we might have already heard it, might have listened, and were operated at the International Lighthouse Weekend, too. Have fun with it, folks. I really try to myself, so thank you very much for being patient with me and my subtle humor. There was commentary in the editor's file about public service. The Salvation Army's show of MCOM Force in Joplin, Missouri, on the heels of disaster Saturn, operators rush to assist Missouri tornado victim. Public service columnist is Richard Fisher, KI6SN, Kilo, India 6, Sierra November. Time was of the essence, and June Jeffers, KB0WEQ, wasted no time in getting to the point of her urgent email, quoting, "We are now invited to the disaster," close quote. In the wake of an EF5 tornado that tore apart areas of Joplin, Missouri on May 22, Jeffers, Salvation Army Team Emergency Radio Network Saturn, Missouri, Kansas Division Coordinator, was putting out a call for qualified volunteers to help with emergency communications. Saturn had gotten the okay to help, and this was no drill. In June, the Jasper County Coroner's Office and the Missouri Department of Public Safety put the storm's death toll in Joplin at 153 persons. A Salvation Army Emergency Disaster Services, that's an EDS, team based in Pittsburgh, Kansas, was quickly sent to Joplin on the heels of the storm, quoting here, to help carry out mass feeding for residents and first responders through a mobile feeding kitchen capable of serving thousands of meals a day, said Patrick McPherson, called WW9E, a retired Salvation Army major and national director and founder of Saturn. Teams from Kirksville and Springfield, Missouri were also dispatched. There was an EF5 tornado at the top of the measurement scale, with winds greater than 200 miles per hour. Quotation again, the Kansas and Eastern Missouri Saturn team was activated along with team members and individuals assisted with communications in the affected area, McPherson said, providing help to survivors in locating loved ones through a ham radio network. Communications in Joplin, WW9E said, were challenging. The MOCAN division of Saturn established nets on 3.920 megahertz, that's 75 meters, beginning on May 23 in support of the operation from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and 3 p.m. to 9 p.m. Jeffords, KB0WEQ, the Salvation Army Team Emergency Radio Network Coordinator, made calls for help, including a specific list of requisites, key in assuring operators are equipped and qualified to achieve the duties they are assigned. For example, point, must have Saturn member ID with photo. Point, three operators needed to provide communications at canteens. Must have mobile 2-meter slant for 40 megahertz capability of at least 50 watts output and mobile APRS, that's automatic packet recording system, the amateur radio-based protocol for real-time tactical digital communications of information. Point, one operator to be a rover, able to do APRS and 2 meters 440 megahertz at the same time. Best if you have a pickup truck to deliver supplies, but a large vehicle would be great. Point, Saturn magnetic signs for vehicles. Point, must, with emphasis, have your own power source. Point, need net control operators with high frequency amateur privileges to work from the MCOM trailer. The shopping list went on to request respondents to describe what mobile radio gear they could deploy, what day and time they could report for duty, and for how long, and they were asked, what date does your Saturn ID expire? They thought of virtually everything. There was no time to be wasted on missteps. Only Saturn operators in Kansas and Missouri were being sought as volunteers. Our Saturn MCOM trailer will be on the way by the time you read this email, Jeffers added. It is set up with its own power source, which can be used for recharging small radio batteries. So bring your charging equipment. We will need to start a schedule of those available through Sunday. Let us know what days and times you can spend. The Saturn leadership places high value on sharing details of each day's events in a series of emails that captured the thought and attention to detail that went into the organization's tornado disaster response. For example, these items randomly gleaned from a daily dispatch run through a list of good-to-know items for all volunteers. We have been using between 8 and 10 operators per day. The food delivery seems to be very dependent on our radio operators. Our use of Echolink has seen a few problems, and we are trying to determine how to utilize this mode with the options we want. We felt that having the Echolink connected 24/7 could possibly put an additional strain on the amount of traffic being put into the disaster area. Outside operators would then be capable of transmitting into the Saturn disaster repeater, and this could create problems in getting the work done. So we attempted to set the Echolink where it could be monitored listen only. Ryan Short, KC0BS, and Gil Ludwig, KWA0YCY, have been working to perfect this setup. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the article continues at some length with very specific commentaries about further things that were accomplished through the coordinated efforts of Saturn, the Salvation Army's MCOM force operation. The article put together by Richard Fisher, KI6SN. We commend him for a wonderful job in the work, and the published article contains a lot of full-color illustration of our amateur radio community in action, in its best mode. And in conclusion, when all was said and done, in a posting of support on the unofficial Alberta Canada Saturn blog, disaster responders were praised as, quoting, amazing volunteers who run the Salvation Army Team Emergency Radio Network, Saturn, also known as SHATOS, helping Salvation Army personnel establish communications during relief efforts in Joplin. Relief efforts would not be the same without their assistance. The author signs, 73, Richard Fisher, KI6SN. At the very beginning, folks, you might recall me saying that there are the results in this issue, the August 2011 issue of CQ Magazine, for the 2010, not this year, CQ WWDX Single Sideband Contest. The contributing author here is Bob Cox, C-O-X, amateur call K3EST. First, expanded results on the web. Editor's note. Having more than 6,500 logs submitted for the CQ Worldwide Single Sideband Contest is great, but it does put a squeeze on space. In order to assure that the efforts of all entrants are recognized through the publication of complete line scores, certain other elements of the contest reporting have been moved to the CQ website. So if you'd like to get all the specifics, you can visit CQWWDX contest page and follow the link on the CQAmateurRadio.com website for QRM, expanded top scores listings, and more. The CQ Worldwide is all about fun and lots of activity. Quiet bands come to life during the CQ Worldwide. Just a few entrant commentaries. There was a huge amount of activity on all bands. That was filed by DJ3WE, a German call, I believe. Great contest as always. Lots of activity improved the score over last year's and added some to the DXCC list. What more could I ask? That was from VK4BL, I believe that's Australia. Band conditions were great. We did better than last year with more than 300 more QSOs, two-way contacts. That was submitted by VE3DC from Canada. The CQ Worldwide is a good way to introduce new contesters to our sport. Now, some of you who may be listening for the first or just few times are probably wondering why they're putting results for the past year, 2010, in the magazine. Well, it's really because of what they commented to at the very beginning. The editor's note, having more than 6,500 logs submitted for the CQ Worldwide Single Sideband Contest, obviously puts a strain on the magazine to include everything in one issue. Though, as you've heard me say before, if you have participated into 2010, and if you think you're one of those big guns or just somebody that had a lot of fun that particular weekend, you can begin on page 28 of CQ for August 2011, and the results categorically are listed in quite a few pages throughout the magazine. Nothing apparently is missing, but you have to dig it out, or if you're sight or print impaired, have a friend, most especially an amateur radio friend, share the magazine with you. Earlier in the broadcast, I referred to Brittany Decker, amateur call KB10GL of New Hampshire. Brittany is the CQ Youth Editor. Up close and personal encounter with the power of lightning prompted her to do a little research and share some useful information with all of us who live in lightning-prone areas. That is, all of us. The title, A Striking Story, Lessons Learned from a Close Encounter with Lightning. It was a beautiful August day in New Hampshire, hot, humid, green, and full of summer swells. My brother, my mom, and I were all at Robinson Pond across the street swimming. When the sky started to cloud up and the humidity started to become oppressive, we felt a thunderstorm coming on. We started hearing distant thunder, but it seemed to be far enough away that we could just slowly make our way back home with no problem. My mom and brother went before my friends and I did, and just as we were catching up and crossing the street to my driveway, crack! I saw a red, that's right, red, flash above my house, which at that moment started to smoke profusely. My heart started to race as I thought my house was on fire. Therefore, I went to the house immediately across the street, along with my mom, and we asked to use their phone and to call the fire department. The house was not smoking as badly by this time, and we were a bit calmer. The firefighters checked out the house and said there was no danger. Then we went inside to check out things for ourselves. We discovered that the lightning had done quite a lot of damage. Our projector did not work. Our washer didn't work, our TV was shot, and one radio was damaged beyond repair. Not only that, but our loop antenna had been seared and the two pieces were hanging from the trees looking quite shameful. We also had to catch our dog, Penny, because the dog fence console had been blown in two pieces along with the melted plug, which had been shot straight out of the light socket. Poor Penny had been right on our back porch when the lightning struck, and like the smart dog she was, she booked it right into the woods. Now, you may say that we are very unlucky for that sort of thing to happen. However, we were extremely lucky in one sense. As I said, The thunder had sounded far off, so my mom and my brother had gone to the hot tub to wash off their feet. The lightning struck while their feet were in the hot tub. It was a good thing my dad had installed a surge protector in the hot tub, and it was also a good thing that it appeared afterward that the lightning's power had been dissipated by the time it reached our hot tub. It had, in fact, reached the hot tub, because after that the jets and the heater didn't work. However, the surge protector apparently helped prevent any injuries. Thank goodness. After we collected ourselves, we began talking with the folks from the fire department. We asked if our antenna was to blame for the lightning strike. They said they didn't think so. However, we were not all that convinced yet. Regardless of whether anything in our yard was to blame, we were also to blame for putting our own lives in danger. It is a common misconception that if lightning, thunder, sounds like it is far away, you are safe for a moment. As our experience proves, looks, or rather sounds, that can be deceiving. I asked lightning expert John Jensenius of the National Weather Service in Gray, Maine, about protecting yourself from lightning. He said that if you hear lightning, you need to go inside immediately, because the lightning that caused it was at most 10 miles away, meaning not as far as you may think. The National Weather Service website states, other victims waited too long before seeking shelter. By heading to a safe place 5 to 10 minutes sooner, they could have avoided being struck by lightning. Error two was the fact that we just slowly made our way inside. We shouldn't have dipped our feet or fooled around on the way home. We should have gone straight in. Granted, this wouldn't have prevented the lightning from striking. However, it would have greatly reduced the risk of any of us being injured or killed. Richard Kithill of the National Lighting Safety Institute advises even more caution. He says that in addition to going inside, you also must not touch anything that could conduct electricity. This means no showers, no light switches, no touching televisions, etc. Don't even use a corded phone, as you could go deaf in a lightning strike. Imagine if we had been inside touching the TV at that time, we would have gotten the shock of our lives. As for protecting our appliances, there was no safe thing we could have done from the time we heard the first crack of thunder. John Jensenius of NWS says that in order to be completely safe, you need to unplug everything, and it is not safe to start unplugging things once you've heard thunder. Again, that means that the storm was within 10 miles. The only way to save your appliances, including radios, from lightning is foresight. To sum it up, there are two main things you can do. First, check the weather every day. If lightning is in the forecast, make sure everything is unplugged before you leave for work or your daily activities. This means all power, and for us ham radio operators, coax cables. You must unplug everything well before the storm to eliminate the risk of being injured from the lightning. And to pause for a moment, there's an editor's note here. You also need to balance the risk of a lightning strike against the risks of unplugging certain appliances, such as refrigerators and air conditioners, for the day. However, anything that won't be in use while you're away should be unplugged if lightning is in the forecast. End the editor's note. Second, if you don't regularly check the weather or watch the news, and you think you might forget, it is a good idea to install a few things. First, as the National Electrical Code requires, you must have all grounds grounded to the same place. If not, you will have a grounds voltage mismatch. Check with an electrician if you have added any grounds for your ham equipment. Next, you can buy surge protectors. Although they won't do much for a direct strike, if a nearby strike induces a power surge in your electrical line, surge protectors can save the frustration of having to replace damaged appliances. However, if it is a direct hit, a small surge protector cannot really be expected to reroute 200,000 to 300,000 volts of electricity. For amateur radio operators specifically, it can be helpful to install surge protectors in coaxial feed lines as well as power lines to protect against current induced on the antenna and feed line by a nearby strike. There are many different surge protectors to choose from, and two good companies that sell them are Polyphaser and Alpha Delta. The pictures of surge protectors that are on this page I have included are from these companies. You can get plug-in surge protectors for about $20 each. However, unplugging everything, radios and antennas, is still the best precaution, along with grounding your unplugged feed line. At this point, you may be asking, well, what about the good old lightning rod? Both Jensenius and Kithill agree that lightning rods will not prevent a strike because lightning is capricious. Lightning rods really have only one purpose, which is to prevent fire by diverting the energy from a strike to ground and away from your house. Lightning searches for the most conductive object, and in the choice of wood versus metal, the lightning rod generally will win. Therefore, a lightning rod is a good idea overall, especially if you live in an area that is prone to frequent lightning strikes. Now, back to our original question, was our antenna to blame for the lightning strike? The answer is simply no. It is not likely. Our antenna is about 100 feet in the air, and taller trees surround it. This means it is highly unlikely that our antenna coerced the lightning to strike our house. This is how John Jensenius described the way lightning acts. First, when a bolt of lightning comes down, it is totally and completely random. It is called the step leader. When it reaches about 200 feet above ground, it looks for tall objects. This could mean objects of any material, wood, metal, anything. Since our antenna was under 200 feet in height, it is unlikely that this was the cause of the strike hitting our house. Finally, if someone is in fact struck by lightning, call 911 immediately and begin performing CPR if the person is not breathing. This will help him or her survive until reaching a hospital. The National Weather Service website advises that lightning victims, quoting here, do not carry an electrical charge. They are safe to touch and need urgent medical attention. Cardiac arrest is the immediate cause of death. Some deaths can be prevented if the victim immediately receives the proper first aid. Call for help. Call 911 or your local ambulance service. Give first aid. Do not delay CPR if the person is unresponsive or not breathing. Use an automatic external defibrillator if one is available. If possible, move the victim to a safer place. Lightning can strike twice. Don't be a victim. About 58 people in the United States are killed every year from lightning, and one of every 10 people who are struck dies. My own experience serves as a scary what-could-have-been story that I hope will open your eyes to the danger of lightning as much as it has opened ours. This completes the story titled A Striking Story, Lessons Learned from A Close Encounter with Lightning by CQ Youth Editor Brittany Decker. Amateur call KB1OGL. However, for the listener, I will give you the model numbers of both of these surge protectors that Brittany referred to. Polyphaser VHF slant UHF surge protector could be model ISB50LNC2. The Alpha Delta model shown is TT3G50. Again, many thanks to Brittany for that sage and experienced advice. I find an article on contesting next. Ergonomics is the title. The author is George Tranos, T-R-A-N-O-S, amateur radio call N2GA. I'll include some of this for those of you who might be aspiring in the near future to setting up a station and want some ideas how best to lay it out. This is a rather long article, and it can get complicated toward the end. I'll give you just some bits and pieces, sort of tantalizing ones, hopefully, for you to pick your own choices and, if need be, talk to someone else about helping you set up your station. Ergonomics. A ham in a typical radio contest can be compared to a runner in a marathon. Each must be prepared in advance to be competitive and must run the event as an endurance contest. Like the marathoner, the contester must have the right strategy, the right equipment, and the proper mindset. For contesting, the right equipment includes having an appropriate contest-grade radio, antennas, filtering, switching equipment, keying devices, computers, interface cables, and other hardware. All of these items are important in the heat of battle. However, it may be even more important to have the right software, the proper chair, operating table, and ergonomics, so that you can maximize your time in the seat. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines ergonomics as an applied science concerned with designing and arranging things people use so that the people and things interact most efficiently and safely, called also biotechnology, human engineering, human factors. For radio amateurs, the operator-to-radio interface can make a difference between winning and losing. An improper chair or a table at the wrong height can cause discomfort, fatigue, and loss of concentration. Good ergonomics can help you achieve your goals by helping you stay in the chair and continue to make contacts. A good chair should provide support, be comfortable, and allow free movement of your arms. It should not chafe, cut, or cause any pain. The seat should have some cushioning, but not compressed so much that you will feel the wood or metal base. It should allow some airflow, if possible, and be made of soft yet durable fabric. The base of the chair should be secure. If a rolling chair is utilized, consider one with 5 versus 4 legs to prevent a tip over. The ability to adjust the height of the chair is important, as you want to position yourself so both your feet and arms are comfortable. I prefer chairs with padded and adjustable armrests, but some operators prefer chairs without arms. The back of the chair should support your back properly. Again, an adjustable back is preferred to allow the chair to be positioned so it supports you when you are seated at the operating table. A chair with some back movement might also allow you to shift position to tolerate longer stints seated. Your operating table or desk is another component in the ergonomic equation. Key factors in a good operating table include one that is at the proper height, has enough room for all of the necessary equipment, and allows positioning of that equipment in an optimal way to allow easy manipulation of controls. Another consideration is the arrangement of your equipment. You must decide what gear will be closest to you and where it will be placed. Consider placing the most frequently used items nearest to you and those things that are less used farther away. Now, as respect to equipment layout, many contesters today utilize computers as the primary component during contest operation. As such, consider positioning your computer display at the center of your operating table directly in front of you. It should be at a good focal distance for your eyes and at the right height so your neck is in a comfortable position. You don't want to look up or down too much, so the screen has to be elevated just right. You might want to consider a shelf or shelves to hold your display screen and some of your other equipment. Your keyboard and mouse are also important items and should be placed properly. The keyboard will be the most touched device during the contest, especially if you plan on running a lot. The height of the keyboard is paramount. It must allow you to position your arms and wrists in a comfortable way. Some contesters place the keyboard directly on the operating table in front of the radio. I personally prefer a keyboard drawer. In this configuration, the keyboard is slightly lower than the table and closer to you. This allows you to move slightly closer or farther from the screen. It also lets you move your hands above the keyboard easily to tune or adjust the radio. Some keyboard drawers also position the mouse or other pointing device on the drawer. This takes it off the desk to allow other accessories such as paddles, switches, and antenna rotators to be closer. The layout of your station can also be done in different configurations depending upon the room and the space you have available. Options include straight corner, U-shaped, or V-shaped. Placing items at any configuration besides a straight table permits the gear to wrap around you to make it easier to reach controls. The U-shaped pattern is becoming more popular. You can place your monitor in the center with one radio on each side for a single operator, two radio setup. This makes it easy to know which radio is your left and which is your right when you are fatigued. Your switching scheme should have left and right marked clearly as well. If you are a single radio operator, place the radio where it can be easily reached with your preferred hand for tuning. I tune with my left hand and leave my right hand free for the mouse, antenna rotator, and the paddles. When operating with one radio, I place it slightly to the left of the display with my rotator close at hand on the right. Remember to keep everything accessible. When setting up a new station, leave room to walk behind the operating table. This adds flexibility and allows changes to be made easily. Wires and cables can be added, changed, and removed. It also makes tracking down problems much quicker and easier without having to crawl underneath desks or move equipment. Clearly label all of your coax feed lines, switches, and controls. Make sure the writing is legible and easy to read. It is easy to make mistakes during the middle of a contest when you are tired and may not be thinking clearly. Proper labeling helps prevent that from happening. And remember, eat, drink, and stay awake. Like the athlete, you need fuel to keep you going during a long contest. Choose the proper food and drink that will invigorate you and keep you energized. Don't eat heavy meals that will make you sleepy. Consider small, frequent meals to equalize your blood sugar levels. It is a personal choice, and every successful contester has his or her own eating and drinking plan. If you haven't considered this in the past, try protein-rich sources of food for long-term energy. Drink enough fluids so you don't dehydrate. Avoid all alcoholic beverages. Until after the contest, maybe. Most of all, have the food ready and available to eat. Think about keeping a small cooler near you at the operating location so you can snack and drink when needed without having to get up. So in closing, more time in the chair will equate to more contacts, and the longer you are able to sit, the higher your score will be and the better you will do. Create an environment that is conducive to long-term operating. This will maximize your comfort and minimize distractions. Good lighting, proper ventilation, and temperature control will also help. Your radio shack should be a place where you want to spend time, not a cave that you can't wait to crawl out of. Take the time to create the right ergonomic setting, and it will pay off in higher scores, less pain and fatigue, and just plain more fun. 73's George and 2GA. I'll conclude with just a little bit from DX by Carl Smith, N4 Alpha Alpha, November 4 Alpha Alpha. It's titled DX News, 6 Meters, and QSL Ling. It's been a fairly quiet summer DX season so far. The sun has been playing games with us. The on-again-off-again status of activity on the sun has many wondering what the heck is going on. Frankly, I don't think anyone knows, and definitely not for sure. They seem to be guessing, although with knowledge as far as that is deemed possible as far as nature goes. Kind of like those who predict the end of the world. Therefore, we'll just have to wait it out for the sun to finally do whatever it's going to do. For now, then, just make the most of whatever we have in the way of propagation, and be thankful we have it. Hams keep asking me when this country or that country is going to be on the air. I only wish I could answer all those questions. There are some that we just know are not going to be on for the foreseeable future. Places such as Yemen and North Korea are not going to be granting permission for any activity that I can foresee. There are some on the African continent that won't be seeing much, if any, action anytime soon either. Entities such as Libya, Sudan, and Somalia are off the table, in my opinion. However, that is my opinion, and everyone is entitled to their own opinion. In reference to 6 meter activity, 6 meters is getting a lot of attention, with more and more radios coming out with 6 and even higher VHF slant UHF bands built in. Folks are taking an interest in using those bands. Also, this time of year, 6 meters gets very active. I'm getting a large number of reports from US DXs who are working some pretty fair DX on the magic band, as it's known. With the sun playing its games, the magic band is holding its own and providing a lot of fun and many counters for VHF, DXCC, the DX Challenge, and other awards. Have you tried it? Maybe it's time you did. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as a conclusion to this submission, the author also includes a commentary on LOTW, that's Log Book of the World, which has pretty much become the standard for exchanging acknowledgement cards, which we call QSL cards. It's titled LOTW, The Unintended Consequences. The submitting author here is Nigel Cawthorne, C-A-W-T-H-O-R-N-E, an English operator, Golf 3 Tango X-Ray Foxtrot G3TXF. There is a rather extensive explanation of this logbook of the world QSLing system, which is a very big feature for the American Radio Relay League, the ARRL. However, for you to find out more about it, I'm not going to be able to read it at this recording. It's just not enough time. So, the article is LOTW, The Unintended Consequences by Nigel Cawthorne. It's actually on page 88 and 89. Of the August 2011 CQ magazine. If it strikes a particular interest chord in your thinking process, if you can't read it yourself, certainly you'd want to get someone to help you read it and listen to the information that's provided here. It's very extensive, informative, and of course has a lot of acronyms, those letters that mean words, which sometimes I have to really slow down to work on myself. You'll forgive me for that. Well, that pretty much takes care of it for this month's reading of CQ Magazine for August 2011 in digest format. CQ Magazine is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Anti-Amp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Again, a reminder to you, Handy Ham for our purposes is lowercase one word, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M at Courage, courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We're located right here on Buzzards Bay, the entranceway to good old Cape Cod. If any of you would wish to make comments, good, bad, or otherwise, or constructive, certainly, my email is n1blf@comcast.net. That's my call sign, n1blf@comcast.net. Thanks again for listening along with me this month on the Courage Handy Ham System. 73, Bob Zeta.